Big news! The sale of the season is here. It's Wayfair's Black Friday sale, and it's on now. Right now, get up to 80% off everything home and everything you need for the season ahead. Save on quality furniture for every room in the house. Essentials for the guest room, whether it's new bedding or a new mattress. Kitchen and dining must-haves for all your hosting needs. And seasonal home finds like throw pillows and decor. Or favorites that you'll use all year long. And with amazing doorbuster deals from November 27th through December 2nd, you can shop the things you love at even lower prices at Wayfair. Plus, you can sit back and relax with Wayfair's fast and easy shipping. Everything home comes straight to your home. And the best part? Free delivery just in time for the holidays. This Black Friday, Wayfair deals are bigger and better than ever. There's no place like home for the holidays. And no place like Wayfair for Black Friday savings. So don't wait. Black Friday ends soon. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now and save up to 80% off at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hey, football fans. Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
What do you think of when you hear the term ghost town? Is it the remnant of some old town from the Western Gold Rush? Maybe a saloon and a local post office and a dusty street where cowboys used to face off and then go have a sarsaparilla with the local can-can girls in their petticoats? I have to stop watching 1883 with country superstars Tim McGraw and Faith Hill. Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I'm a writer and an actor who does not belong in the Old West. I don't even belong in the New West. I moved east from there to avoid cowboys and hot, arid weather and, most of all, fires. But fires, stranger, happen. And sometimes they happen in the most outrageous places. And a town, just a regular town, can become, almost overnight, a ghost town. So get your spelunking lights out and join me as we delve into the underground ruins of a corner of America's coal industry. Join me in the living nightmare that is Centralia, Pennsylvania. Columbia County, Pennsylvania, home to the smoking ruin that is the town of Centralia, was once part of Northeast Pennsylvania's rolling green wilderness. An area made up of mountains, rivers, and forests, it was once a place richly inhabited by wildlife and populated by indigenous Americans. All that changed in 1749 when, for reasons that I assume made sense to them at the time, the Native Americans living there sold the land to colonial settlers for £500. Or they were coerced to sell the land. This deal was still 100 years before Andrew Jackson's Indian Removal Act, not to be confused with the Remove Andrew Jackson Act, was passed, and just a few years before the start of the French-Indian War. It was during a time where settlers still had somewhat uneasy but civil relations with the natives of the area, so it's hard to say why they made the deal. It could be that for indigenous people, the idea of owning land was so preposterous that they kind of thought, yeah, sure, you can buy this land from us, LOL, joke's on you. And then they realized too late that the joke was definitely on themselves. The point is, the natives sold the land and the colonials rubbed their greedy palms together and started planning what they wanted to put there. After about 20 years in possession of the land, colonial settlers began to survey, explore, and of course, deforest the wilderness of Columbia to build what would become the Reading Road. The Reading Road was a trail that would link Reading, Pennsylvania to Fort Augusta. Today, Route 61 pretty closely follows that trail, cutting a swath northwest across Pennsylvania. The road was developed by those who lived along it and set the stage for future land development in the region. In 1793, a Revolutionary War hero and one of the signatories of the Declaration of Independence, Robert Morris, acquired the land. Though Morris had once been the richest man in America, he went bankrupt in 1798 and was sent to debtor's prison. If only some aspects of history would repeat themselves. Like if only we could pick and choose. I know one thing I would choose. Anyway, before Morris got and lost the land that would eventually become Centralia, anthracite coal, or hard coal, was discovered in Pennsylvania, and the first anthracite mine was established there in 1775 in a town called Pittston, just 75 or 80 miles north of Morris's land. After Morris's misfortune and the loss of the land, according to CentraliaPA.org, quote, at an auction held in Philadelphia in 1830, a former French sea captain named Stéphane Girard purchased Morris's lands for the total amount of $30,000. Girard had heard there was anthracite coal in the area. His later survey of land confirmed this to be true, end quote. So Girard became the next owner of the land and just kind of sat on it as change set in for the region. In 1832, a fellow named Jonathan Faust opened a place in the area called the Bull's Head Tavern. The tavern was literally the only place around, and it was for the tavern that the town was originally named. Bull's Head, Pennsylvania was created. I suppose they should be lucky Faust didn't name his tavern Gobbler's Crotch. The tavern and the subsequent mines, the first two of which opened in 1856, sat on top of one of the largest anthracite coal deposits in the world. Once folks in the biz, and by that I mean the biz of plundering Mother Earth, not the business of show, got wind of what was underneath Bull's Head, bigger interests came sniffing around. In 1842, the Locust Mountain Coal and Iron Company purchased Girard's land and the land surrounding Bull's Head and brought in a mining engineer to begin the planning of a town to support the burgeoning coal industry. Alexander W. Ray moved his family to the area and started dreaming up the future Centralia. Though small coal mines existed near Bull's Head, large-scale coal mining really began in 1854 after the completion of the Mine Run Railroad when Locust Mountain built its large colliery, which was overseen by Alexander Ray. Ray mapped out the future of the town, deciding on the locations of streets and giving the new town a new name, Centerville. He was imagining a future commerce center for the region when he drew up his plans. But Ray's request that the United States Postal Service put a post office in his town was rejected. Apparently, there was already a Centerville in the county, so Ray had to rename the town, and for reasons that were apparent to no one but himself, he chose the name Centralia. It makes me wonder when we started caring if there were two of anything in America. Like, everyone knows Atlanta has 87,000 Peachtree streets, avenues, and roads, and even though it's hella confusing, no one cares. Here in Rhode Island, there are approximately 4,200 streets called Park, 5,600 Warrens, and I swear there's about 6 million things called Narragansett, after the people who were slaughtered and or driven away from here. Oh, and we have a Centerville, too. And a Centerdale. I guess at some point we just threw up our hands and were like, we have way bigger things to worry about. Anyway, in 1866, Centralia, Pennsylvania was incorporated as a borough and was now officially too legit to quit. The town had a starting population of around 1,300 and continued to grow over the years into a thriving industrial mecca. Unfortunately for Ray, though, he wouldn't be around to see this version become a reality. One October day in 1868, Alexander Ray was driving his buggy from Mount Carmel to Centralia, Pennsylvania. According to CentraliaPA.org, quote, along the way, he was ambushed by a group of men. Later, these men would be identified as Molly Maguire's. Sadly, Ray was killed, and the money he had with him was taken, end quote. The Molly Maguire's were an Irish nationalist secret society that operated in Ireland, Liverpool, and Pennsylvania, where there was a large Irish immigrant population. They behaved as muscle men against landlords and coal mine owners. The article goes on to say, quote, initially several men were arrested and charged. However, they were soon acquitted of the murder. The crime would go unsolved until 1876. In that year, a man named Kelly the Bum confessed to the murder. Kelly also implicated Patrick Hester, Patrick Tully, and Peter McHugh as being co-conspirators. The men were quickly convicted and sentenced to death. They were hung in Bloomsburg, PA, on March 25, 1878. End quote. CentraliaPA.org also says of Ray, quote, Alexander W. Ray was the founder of Centralia, Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, much of his story and early life have been lost to history. There are also no known pictures of Ray either. End quote. Also, either. R.I.P. Alexander Ray, but you know, stranger, as sad as it is that Ray's legacy can just about fit inside of a coal miner's helmet, it's sadder still that the great and enduring vision he held of a town thriving and pulsing with life has been turned in on itself to become a reality that is the polar opposite of what Ray had hoped for when he was drawing up his plans for Centralia.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
An article on spoonfeeds.com about Centralia pinpoints when things shifted for the bustling coal town. Quote, by 1890, its population peaked at 2,761 people. And by 1927, anthracite mining was at its peak. 2 years later, though, the Wall Street crash had a massive impact on the economy, resulting in many mines closing. End quote. So coal mining took a big hit when the Depression happened, along with the rest of America's working class industry, including Centralia's other main interest, the lumber industry. Many Centralia sawmills closed in 1929 and 1930 because of the drop in demand for logging. But Centralia was not destroyed by these changes, as so many similar settlements were during those times. The Centralia residents stayed afloat in part because they actually created a relief fund to help members of the community. Because that's how we do here in the good old U.S. of A. But according to online periodical The Chronicle, quote, over time, the abandoned mills burned down. Mills never regained their presence in Centralia after the Depression. After World War II, Centralia remained a logging and mining town, but some new industry started up in town. End quote. One of those new industries was something desperate miners without many prospects did in those days called bootleg mining. Bootleg miners extracted coal from the decommissioned abandoned mines by doing something called pillar robbing. This meant they would dig out all the coal, including what was left that supported the roof of the mine. This, as I'm sure you can imagine, created significant instability in the mine shafts, which created the potential for mine collapse. After the war, in the relief and relative prosperity that followed in the 1950s, two more roads were built around Centralia. The White Pass Highway in 1951 and Interstate 5, which bypassed the downtown area of Centralia in 1955. These changes brought tourism to the area for the first time and altered the development of the region as the freeway corridor emerged as a main artery of trade and travel. Around the same time, the Centralia Council, hoping to relive the town's prosperous past, gained the mineral rights so they could take over control of the coal mining industry in the region. Still, while coal mining continued into the 1960s, it eventually mostly shut down too. The once booming Centralia, Pennsylvania, which had at its peak 14 operating coal mines and about 2,500 residents, was becoming a shell of its former self. In the 1960s, as Centralia's mines were gradually abandoned, the citizens of Centralia began to leave to look for work and try life elsewhere. Even so, Centralia still held on to a population of a little over 1,000 people, and the little coal mining town kept on until something even more devastating than a crashing economy happened to clinch the working class exodus. Only the disaster that did Centralia in didn't happen in the town. It happened under the town. On May 7th, 1962, when most Pennsylvanians were welcoming spring and warm weather, the Centralia City Council met to talk about cleaning up the Centralia landfill. The landfill had been created earlier that year and was a 300-foot-wide, 75-foot-long pit that had been made from an old converted strip mine. In an article from History.com, Aaron Blakemore writes, quote, "Trash was a thorny issue in Centralia, which was full of unregulated dumps, and the city council wanted to solve the problem with unwanted odors and rats," end quote. By "with unwanted odors and rats," I believe she means of unwanted odors and rats, I have to assume. One doesn't solve any problem with odor and rats. Anyway. So I think this means the landfill in question was an unregulated and illegal dump. I can't imagine why else the landfill would have been created and then the city would seek to get rid of it all in the same year. In any case, the council was keen to do the cleaning up so that there would be no rat-filled garbage underground when the town was ready to have its big Memorial Day celebration. I don't know why they were so fixed on making things nice for this one holiday when things had just been going along like they were for a while in Centralia. Maybe it had to do with the town trying to lick its wounds and recover from the economic breakdown of the previous decades. Or maybe it was the horrific brush with a serial killer that put Centralia in the news the year before, when Frank Earl Senk raped and murdered 13-year-old Centralia resident Jane Benfield and left her body at one of the many abandoned mines. Senk has the dubious distinction of being Pennsylvania's first serial killer. Whatever the reason, the council was committed to clearing out the landfill. Author David Decock talks about the choice to eradicate the dump and the method of doing so in his book about Centralia, Fire Underground. Quote, "This might seem like irrelevant small-town history, except for one thing. Centralia Council's method for cleaning up a dump was to set it on fire," end quote. That's right, stranger. The preferred method of cleaning up a subterranean landfill was to light that shit on fire. Because when you burn stuff, it goes away. The air quality implications alone give me sympathetic wheezing. And I thought modern American politics were a dumpster fire. And they are. But also, this Centralia thing is a literal underground dumpster fire. Like, what is it with humans just burying and burning everything we don't want to face up to? And then be like, "Happy Memorial Day!" Oof. The town was built on top of vast amounts of coal, don't forget. And even though a lot of that coal had been mined, there was still plenty of coal still down there. And here's the thing about coal. It burns. That's like its claim to fame. History.com describes what happened after the city council lit their underground cleanup dumpster fire. Quote, "Soon a fire was raging in a coal seam beneath Centralia. It spread to mine tunnels beneath town streets, and the local mines closed due to unsafe carbon monoxide levels," end quote. Because of course it did. I'm no engineer, but I lived in L.A., Everyone knows when you light a great big fire and give it somewhere to go with plenty of fuel and oxygen, it's gonna grow and consume anything it can. So was it any surprise when the fire went whoosh and engulfed the mine shafts full of anthracite coal dust? Except that apparently it was a surprise. That is, when it was eventually discovered. Because here's the thing, stranger, the remaining citizens of Centralia didn't even know there was a fire raging beneath their feet. According to online history blog utown.com, quote, "This was not discovered until several years later when people attending a church near the landfill began to complain about the foul-smelling, sulfurous odors rising from the ground. The proper authorities were brought in, and high levels of carbon monoxide confirmed that the coal vein was on fire, end quote. Holy hell on earth, stranger. Can you imagine what it must have been like in this town over these few years? All the women in Centralia must have thought they were going through the change of life as they had unexplained hot flashes morning, noon, and night. And everyone else was probably thinking, am I having a stroke or has the devil come to take me, as they smelled sulfur and burning and didn't know why. And I'm not the only one to compare what was happening to Centralia to hell. Someone on GettysburgGhosts.com said when describing Centralia, quote, if hell decided to relocate to Earth and claim a zip code, it would inevitably have to sue Centralia for infringing its brand image rights, end quote. Colorful. Once they figured out that there was fire under their home, the local government attempted to extinguish it, of course. They tried and tried and tried again. They sought help from the federal government, but those attempts failed too. Funny, I guess when miles of tunnels, thousands of feet underground with an exposed coal seam in them catch fire, it's not so easy to put out. When authorities realized the scope of the fire, they closed the few mines that were still operational for safety reasons. Those mines never reopened. Mining in Centralia was officially over. And the fire? Well, it just burned. What was left for the people of Centralia? Well, it was still home to 1,000 or so residents, and it isn't easy to pull up stakes and relocate, especially when you're poor. And so Centralia continued in spite of everything, limping into the 70s and 80s. The downtown area tried to reinvent itself in the 1980s as a quaint historical commercial district, trying to find appeal as a shopping destination. That seemed to revitalize things for a while, but it wasn't enough to save the town that was perennially on fire. History.com writes, quote, as the years went on, the ground beneath the city itself became hotter and hotter, reaching over 900 degrees Fahrenheit in some locations. Smoke poured from sinkholes and gas-filled basements. Residents started to report health problems, and homes began to tilt. Even the dead cannot rest in peace, wrote Greg Walter for People in 1981. Graves in the town's two cemeteries are believed to have dropped into the abyss of fire that rages below them. By then, it was too late for Centralia, end quote. I mean, call me crazy, you wouldn't be the first, but I'd say it was too late for Centralia a good three decades earlier. The article continues, quote, rather than put out the fire, Congress decided to buy out its residents, paying them to move. Then, in 1992, Pennsylvania moved to kick the holdouts out for good, end quote. Sigh, there are always holdouts, and I get it. Again, this place, for all of its post-apocalyptic charm, was home for these folks. It was where they were born, lived, had relationships, had kids, lost loved ones. And what was out there waiting for them elsewhere? They would have to start over. Meanwhile, the government would buy up what was left of Centralia and profit from the mining of the coal vein that still existed underground and maintained a fair bit of market value. That is, I guess, except for the stuff that was on fire. If the coal remained in the hands of the town, the residents maintained some leverage. But if the last 46 people were to relocate, they would lose and the government could take what was left. In the effort to push the holdouts out, Centralia's buildings were universally condemned in 1992. Though it does seem like even existing in the town at this point was a safety hazard. In one harrowing incident a few years before, a 12-year-old kid fell into what CentraliaPA.com describes as, quote, a hot, steaming hole created by mine fire subsidence, end quote. Todd Domboski was walking along when he sank into the smoky underground. He managed to grab an exposed root and scream for help. A cousin heard him and was able to pull the boy to safety. He was unharmed, but the incident was a close call, and the longer the fire burned in Centralia, it was less and less likely to be an isolated one. And falling into a giant hellhole is not the only thing to worry about under these conditions. There's the poisonous gases to consider, and the fact that this giant fire, like a living thing, moves around. The beast had covered over 400 acres and has, by some metrics, grown 75 feet a year since it started. But putting the fire out, it turns out, is not only difficult, but would be expensive enough that some don't think it's worth doing. According to Smithsonian.com, quote, over some 20 years, firefighters tried 8 times to put it out. First, they dug trenches, but the fire outpaced them. Then they attempted flushing, a process that involves augering holes into or ahead of a fire and pouring down wet sand, gravel, slurries of cement, and fly ash to cut off oxygen. Flushing nearly always fails because of the difficulty of filling every pore space. In addition, because fire coals can exceed 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, most fill material burns away, leaving more gaps. For both of these reasons, the flushing attempt did not succeed. Next, state and federal geologists drilled hundreds of exploratory boreholes to define the fire, then dug a huge trench across its supposed path. But the fire had already spread beyond the trench. Some critics believe the digging helped ventilate the fire. Flooding the area with water was rejected. It is nearly impossible to inundate a large underground area, especially one as complex and well-drained as Centralia. In any case, water would have to be pumped in for years to dissipate the fire's heat. A final solution, to dig a pit 3/4 of a mile long and deep as a 45-story building, would have cost $660 million, more than the value of property in town. It, too, was rejected, end quote. It only cost $42 million to relocate the residents of Centralia. All things considered, Centralia's fate was sealed. In a poetic completion of the circle of the town's life, Centralia's zip code was eliminated in 2002. In 1966, 4 years after the start of the fire, or what some might see as the beginning of the long ending, the residents of Centralia had buried a time capsule. In keeping with the town's legacy, the capsule had basic mining equipment, a helmet, lamp, and some coal, as well as a Bible and a few souvenirs. The capsule was scheduled to be opened in 2016 for the 150th anniversary of Centralia. Bleak as things had gotten, though, and because of attempts to steal it, the time capsule was instead opened on October 4th, 2014. Once opened, there was a foot of water inside. Everything carefully placed inside it had been destroyed. The remains of the time capsule were buried at the old American Legion Post 608. I don't know if there is a better metaphor for what happened to Centralia. Centralia was a town formed out of idealism and founded on the values of industrialism and progress. The people of Centralia believed in its potential and worked hard to forge lives there. But everything they worked for and invested in eventually fell apart, and those people were left with nothing in the end. In 2017, the Philadelphia Inquirer published a piece on the fate of Centralia by Jason Nark. Quote, 7 residents remained via court order. They are forbidden from passing down their property or selling it. Today, Centralia still burns as one of 38 known active mining fires in Pennsylvania. According to the state's Department of Environmental Protection, the fire could burn for another century if left uncontrolled. Modern-day Centralia is known as much for the blaze and the graffiti that covers its abandoned highway, as for the mining that once sustained it. And forget extinguishing the fire that has turned the town from a small mining center to a place infamous for its hidden blaze. As geologist Steve Jones told Smithsonian's Kevin Krajic, putting it out is the impossible dream. End quote. The impossible dream. My dream, stranger, is that human beings will learn from history and will stop eviscerating the earth for our own gain, stop letting greed lead the way to progress, and literally stop digging our own grave. Author David DeCock sums it up very well in his book about the Centralia fire. Quote, "Centralia will live on for a time in the memories of the former residents, but eventually they too will die. Only the written and filmic record will remain to tell this story of how the rape of the land created conditions for the town's destruction, how human misjudgment struck the match, and how bureaucracy let the Centralia mine fire burn, unable to figure out how to stop it. It was indeed a tragedy." End quote. And it's not just this one town's destruction. Similar destruction is indeed happening at a rapid pace everywhere we look, all in the name of progress. In her beautiful book, The Ogress and the Orphans, which was brought to my attention by a listener of my other podcast, Dear Daisy, author Kelly Barnhill tells the tale of a tragic fire that takes out a town's library. Not only does the fire take all the knowledge the library kept safe, but it consumes all the trees as well. And without the trees, there is no shade for people to rest in or from which to shield their eyes from the sun. The relentless heat and glare of the sun make everyone's faces scrunch up into scowls, and they hide behind their locked doors. No one goes outside anymore, and when they do, they all seem to be scowling at each other. Everyone comes to distrust and dislike their neighbors. But also, without the trees, the ground becomes unstable and unable to absorb water, and whole parts of the town disappear into sinkholes. The town falls into disarray, its populace unable to recall a time when things were better, and so resigned to the false idea that this is just how life is. Perhaps the reason some of us refer to Earth as a burning dumpster fire right now is in part because of things like the tragedy of Centralia, a literal dumpster fire fueled by unsustainable expansion and greed underneath an area that was once so beautiful and filled with so much promise. I suppose it might behoove us to reprioritize what our promise looks like. Does it have to be progress at any cost? Or can it perhaps be the promise of livable land on which people, animals, and greenery can grow to continue the existence of our species? So, is mine an impossible dream? I guess that remains to be seen. I have to hold on to some kind of hope that we can do better. After all, we know from this very podcast, stranger things have happened. Next time on Strange and Unexplained, in our last episode of Season 4, we'll be visiting medieval Europe to meet anchorites, people so devoted to God they walled themselves up in tiny cells to spend the rest of their days in solitary worship. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment with help from Grab Bag Collab. This episode was written by Eve Kerrigan and me, Daisy Egan, with research by Keely Hise. Sound design and engineering by Jeff Devine. Music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNU Pod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab. or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange.